Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio with very special guest, Dr. Catherine Ramsland. Today's show is called The BTK Killer and Other Serial Murders, an interview with psychologist and author Dr. Catherine Ramsland. You're going to hear some very, very insightful information, along with possibly how to shop Hallmark for a serial killer card. You might just hear about that. You just never know with Crime and Science Radio. We want to let you all know, of course, that all the shows here on the Suspense Radio Network are brought to you by Kensington Books. So visit KensingtonBooks.com and also Revell Baker Publishing. Visit them at RevellBooks.com and check out their authors and their releases. So let's hit it right now with the host of our show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome everybody once again to Crime and Science Radio. Tonight's very special because we have Catherine Ramsland, who is a dear friend of both Jan and mine, and we love having her on the show. Catherine hadn't done a whole lot in her life. She is the director of the Master of Arts in Criminal Justice program at DeSales University, where she teaches the forensic psychology track as well, besides running the whole program. She's published over 1,000 articles, stories, and reviews, and 59 books to date, and the list goes on and on. She also is a regular contributor for Psychology Today in a post called Shadowboxing, which is great. You should go to Psychology Today and subscribe to that just to read Shadowboxing. It's good stuff. She's also consulted on several television programs, including CSI and Bones. And her most recent book just coming out this month, is Confessions of a Serial Killer, The Untold Story of Dennis Rader, the BTK Killer. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
It's great to have you here. Now, you have been on our show before, and we urge our listeners to go to our websites where you can find indexes to the previous shows and listen to that one as well. But for those who are listening today and who may not have heard that one yet, can you tell us about your education and career?
Well, my education is quite circuitous because when I left high school, I was never going back to school, and now I have 4 graduate degrees. So never say never. And I double majored in psychology and philosophy. I first got a PhD in philosophy, taught that for years, and decided, you know, the heck with this. But I also, at the same time, was getting several master's degrees in psychology. One was in clinical psych, and one was in forensic psychology. And I also sort of detoured to be in experimental psychology, where I ended up cutting off the heads of rats and deciding that was not how I wanted to spend my life. When I became a therapist, I realized I was just a voyeur and not really a therapist. So that was not the career for me. And forensic psychology really ended up being the place I wanted to be, because it really actually works out very well if you're a voyeur, because there's a lot of great stories about people in forensic psychology. But then I ended up writing for the website for Court TV, and that really launched my writing career in a very big way.
Well, let's back up to your initial interest in psychology. Why did that pique your interest in the first place? And then maybe also talk about why the forensic area in particular. You did tell us, you know, that it was okay to be a voyeur, but I'm imagining there's more to it than that.
There is, but you know, I'll just confess, I mean, it was the cute professors, frankly.
Media career.
beginning of many careers, definitely. I think when I actually got into college, it actually was 3 years past what most people do, because I traveled around the country, I hitchhiked around the country right out of high school and did a lot of things before I ended up sort of stumbling into college. And when I did get to college, I was probably, I'm not going to say mature, but maybe I knew a little bit more about what I wanted to do, and I was putting myself through school. So I was doing the double major in philosophy and psychology, and psychology seemed to be, though I loved philosophy, the psychology seemed to be the place that seemed most resonant with me in terms of being able, I'm not going to say I was a good listener to human beings because I wasn't, but I was really curious about human beings and how they would get from, you know, who they were as little babies to who they became. And, of course, the most extreme examples of that would be extreme offenders like mass murderers and serial killers. So my curiosity was really what drew me to psychology, is how do people become what they are? That is the primary question that has always completely intrigued me.
Well, I think that intrigues the readers of crime fiction, too, because
sure.
The how is done over and over again. The why often varies. And in real cases, you see that all the time. I know you write and teach extensively on all types of psychological issues. And I mentioned shadowboxing, which is a great post you put up frequently. What publications do you frequently write for, and how do they vary from one to the other? How do you decide what topics and how you're going to write it?
Well, I mean, I do the Psychology Today post every week. So that's just whatever strikes me. Something in the news, for example, or a collection of things. Like I just did one on 4 cases in the news of teenagers who wanted to be serial killers and started off by killing their best friends. So that was recently in the news, 4 different cases. So I'll do collections of cases, or I'll do crime news. I will do thematic things like cognitive maps and how that affects observation and forensic science, for, you know, whatever strikes me. But I also write a column for Sisters in Crime. I've been doing that for probably 7 years for their newsletter. Here's some psychological tips for your characters. I have been writing for Serial Killer Quarterly since it began, but that recently has decided to fold. So that's unfortunate, because I was contributing cases in just about every issue in that. And so I don't think that I have anything that is absolutely regular right now, aside from that column and my Psychology Today thing. But I used to write a lot for the Forensic Examiner. I wrote for every issue of the Forensic Examiner for a number of years, and I'm not doing that anymore.
That's another excellent publication, but Serial Killer Quarterly, wow.
It was fantastic to write for that. It was fantastic, and they let me do whatever I wanted, and I loved writing in narrative, nonfiction style, so exploring new cases, and so I was really sad to hear that they're not going to keep going.
Yeah.
I bet that's a subscription list the FBI would want to know about.
Yeah, they live next door to you, Jen. It's the 14-year-old down the street. Let's get into this. Talk about some dark stuff that I know you like so well.
Darker than what we've been talking.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go dark, Doug.
Yeah, we usually do. There's a... people listening may or may not know the classifications of multiple murderers and what the differences are in, you know, mass and spree and serial. Can you give us a thumbnail on how we categorize people who kill a bunch of people?
Okay, well, I'll give you a thumbnail, and then I'll tell you that it's changed. So
yeah.
the original designation was multicide, to cover all sins of any kind of repeat or huge nature, was multicide. And then it sort of became 3 categories. One was mass murderer, which is, depending on which criminologist you ask, is either 3 or 4 or more in a single incident or loosely related incidents.
Right.
So you hear the vagueness in that. So, like, for example, if you get a guy who walks around the neighborhood, like Howard Unruh in 1949, and kills 12 people or 13 people in 12 minutes. Well, is that a mass murderer? you know, yeah. they think so. Spree killer would be somebody who has that kind of same mass murder mentality, like something sets them off, and then they keep killing across geographical locations or across days or weeks, even months, but with the same precipitating events still under their skin. Like they still have the mass murder mentality, but they've stretched it out. A serial killer used to be known as someone who committed three or more murders in three or more incidents in three or more locations with a cooling off period in between. But that changed in 2005 when the FBI had an international convocation and did a publication, which you can find on the government website, deciding to eliminate spree killer as a category and change serial killer into someone who kills at least two victims in two separate incidents. They took off the cooling off period and they took out the locations because we do have serial killers who always bring them back to the same location. So they realized that their definition was problematic, but also was impractical for law enforcement because they couldn't figure out what a cooling off period was. But now let me just put one more thing in there. Researchers still find the categories of mass spree and serial killer to be useful. So researchers, criminologists, or forensic psychologists will still continue to talk about the spree killer despite the FBI's decision to eliminate it because it is still a useful psychological category. So that's a long answer to your question, but
that's a great
it is
answer.
A complex question.
That's a great answer.
Yeah.
Well, to just look at the one group of serial killers, they aren't all the same. What are the more common motives for serial killers, and what are some of the differences between them?
You know, I'm glad you asked because I actually wrote a book to address exactly that because I sort of got tired of everybody thinking that serial killers are always motivated sexually. And so I wrote a book called Inside the Minds of Serial Killers to address the multitude of motivations, sometimes more than one, but certainly things like greed or profit has been part of it. Eliminating witnesses is sometimes part of it. Certainly lust, obviously, but also the feeling of control or power over a victim has been part of it. Deviance, some kind of, or psychosis. We certainly have psychotic serial killers. There was one in California who believed that if he killed 13 people, he would save the state of California from, you know, being washed under by an earthquake and a tsunami. And as it turned out, he actually did get 13 victims. So you Californians need to be very grateful to this serial killer.
Yeah, he was right. We're still here.
Maybe he wasn't psychotic after all. But some people are motivated by what we call paraphilias, which are weird sexual or ritualistic kinds of things. That's not the same thing as lust. It can become an addiction or a compulsion. They have a variety of things. Some are anger-based. They want to be punitive, so they might have a mission to kill, like they want to rid the world of prostitutes or, you know, something like that. So you have to really look at the cases. I mean, we have, well over 1,000 cases of serial murder to look at, probably over 2,000 cases from around the world, and they are going to be motivated many times in a cultural way. For example, when we did a comparison of Japanese serial killers to American, we found more sex-driven serial killers in America, but more profit or greed-driven serial killers in Japan. And so you can't discount the cultural influence on some of these things. So it's really, because I'm in psychology rather than criminology, I tend to really look more case-specific when I want to talk about how someone became what they are and why they're driven by what they're driven, because I think trend analysis loses a lot when you're trying to group them together in terms of motives. I think motive really, really arises organically out of a lot of factors in somebody's life.
We'll have to save this for another discussion because John and Doug know not to get me talking about death investigation.
Well, we will talk about that.
I have a I have a thing about how poorly we conduct it in the U.S.
Many
jurisdictions. And so I often feel like the statistics around all of this are suspect in terms of even identifying cases.
I'm with you. I'm with you. Definitely.
Yeah. So let's talk about something that won't get me going for an hour. well, it will, but I'm going to let you talk about it.
Yeah, I was going to say there is no topic.
Yeah. Let's talk about BTK, one of the most famous and heinous serial killers with a long and sordid history. And you have a new book about him, so we especially want to talk about that. Why did you decide to write about him and focus on him?
One other thing in my life has been circuitous because I didn't decide. What happened is I got pulled into it unexpectedly. When he was first arrested in 2005, a woman began to write to him because she wanted to write a book with him, from his perspective. She collected 5 years' worth of material, many, many, many letters and whatnot. And I saw her on Facebook and said, because she'd been covered by news reports, and I said, whatever happened to your book on BTK? And she had a book of mine that she was using as a model. So she knew who I was, and she immediately said, please take this over. I can't keep going with this for a variety. She had a number of reasons.
Sure.
She had a lot of things in her life that were really preventing her from being able to do it. She asked if I would take it over. So just saying yes wasn't simple. I had to be approved because his life rights are owned by the victims' families. There's like a conglomeration of the victims' families. So they are the ones who benefit from the book, not me. They do. But they had to approve me.
Huh,
so I had to go through this whole legal thing. It wasn't just a matter of saying, yeah, I think I'd like to write that book. But anyway, and then, of course, Rader had to approve me. So it wasn't like I chose him. He chose me. And so we began this five-year odyssey of writing his dark path, as he would like to call it. How did he get to be what he was?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. I mean, this obviously was a long project. I knew that. I didn't realize it was all of 5 years. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
That's huge. So this research where you were interacting with various people, I assume you had some interactions with Rader and with some of the victims' families and things like that. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Well, I mean, the victims' families were not, and I did ask them, I did meet with some of them. I did ask them to please not think that this is your book. It isn't your book. It's his book. And you don't want to put your story parallel to his.
Right.
You will get the proceeds. Walk away. That's what you should do, is what I've told them. Don't look at this. Don't think about this. This is not your story. That's for a different kind of book. This is his point of view. It's like what I call a guided autobiography. So he's writing to me and talking to me about his memories and experiences, and then I, because I have the training in psychology, am guiding it with, like I'll send him something to look at, and we'll discuss it in terms of how it is relevant to something that he's been talking about. So I'll try to put some backbone, some academic backbone to it as a guide, but it's his story. And so I told the victims' families who wanted it to be their story, this is not an appropriate place for you. And they ultimately agreed with me. But, yeah, I've had some interactions with them, with their attorney. We immediately hit it off on The Walking Dead, so we were good to go right there. And then once it was all in place, then Rader and I would communicate, and he would write. I'm telling you, this guy has what I call hypergraphia. He writes long, 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 long letters. And we had weekly phone calls. We had some prison visits, which I found to be immediately ineffective because when you're in a maximum security prison, you are not alone. The guards hover. Everything's recorded. There's really very little you can do that's effective communication. But on the phone, we had our weekly phone calls. That really was where a lot of work got done. through codes, because we had codes, you know, the phone calls are recorded as well. But we had codes that we used to communicate. And I'd say most of the really good work was done that way, as well as the writing that he did.
Can you give us an example of a code? You know, not going to give too much away, but because I'm not sure you cover it in the book. But
well, the first
an
thing that he
was.
Did, yeah, the first thing he did to test me, which I made the introduction to the book, was he sent me a bunch. This is so crazy. He sent me a bunch of newspaper clippings where he circled things and he wrote half of an alphabet, and then he sent the other half to someone else. And she had some other things. So between her and me, we had to piece together what each of the letters corresponded to on the circled items on the newspapers. And it was really weird at first. Like he'd say, you know, it was one of my favorites. He'd say, I understand you're collecting recipes of the three-layer kind. And I thought, what? I don't cook. What's he talking about? Well, three layers, BTK, you know, so seems obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me.
As opposed to the BLT, I guess, right?
The BLT, and then suddenly everything that had B's became, you know, this is when he's talking about what the B stands for. So he then would send me items circled, and then I'd have to try to figure out what is he getting at. And that took me a while. But then eventually it evolved. Then we had to change the code because that's part of the, you know, to make sure nobody knows what we're talking about. And then eventually I made the code. Like I created a very elaborate, complex code based on things I knew he would resonate to. And our final communications were all through the code that I made. So you can kind of see how it turned from him making all the decisions and keeping me off balance to finally he's taking the code that I created. So the trust was there. Now, that doesn't mean he wasn't lying to me. I'm sure he was sometimes.
Sure.
But there's an advantage that I had that the other person didn't have, and that was that I also knew the DA very well, and she gave me an awful lot of stuff, including the police video. So I had that perspective. I had my perspective. I had the other woman's perspective, and I had perspective from several other people that he was writing to. So I could watch his behavior with various people and see more than I would be able to see if I were only looking at my interactions with him. So I had more of a sort of a hawk's eye view of his behavior so that I could actually, and I actually just gave a presentation at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences about this, about how Kierkegaard helped me understand BTK. But that's another story. But I was able to see layers of behavior because I had a number of different sources in terms of how he would be with various people. And that, I thought, was probably the most revelatory stuff I could have had. So it was always many layers going at once.
Wow. Well, you know, a lot of our listeners may not, you know, obviously they know who BTK, know about BTK and all that, but they probably don't know, they probably don't remember all of it. I mean, he spun
yeah,
out,
I mean,
you know, 40 years ago
to,
and it was captured 10 years ago. So tell us the kind of overview of what he did.
I would say, even though a lot of people kind of only vaguely know who he is, he's probably the most famous living serial killer today, since so many have died or been executed.
Yeah.
He's probably the most famous living serial killer that we know of, like Zodiac, we don't know who he is, et cetera.
Right.
But Dennis Rader was in Wichita. He began killing in 1974, where he killed a whole family of four as his first murder, subsequently killed others until he had 10, and got away with it for nearly 30 years. After 29 years, he resurfaced and began to play a cat-and-mouse game with the police because he wanted more notoriety, and he was having some fun with this idea that no one had caught him all this time. And that was sort of what finally did him in, was he wasn't watching his back and as carefully as he had been earlier. But because he got away with it for 30 years, he did become kind of famous. And then when he was caught, of course, then he confessed. It took about 3 hours. He didn't immediately confess, but they had DNA, and he knew that that was the end of the road for him. But he was a family man. He was president of his church congregation. He had two kids. He had a job. He defied just about every stereotype of any serial killer any serial killer stereotype we had, he defied. And he was 59 when he was caught. So he is an interesting study because of the way he developed into a serial killer is unlike what most have done. And the fact that he got away with it for so long before he was caught. It's kind of like the Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway, who also got away with his crimes for quite a long time.
What about his motives? What do you think drove him to do what he did?
Well, it was sort of a complex of things. When he was a teenager, he started reading true crime detective magazines like Bundy did, and he started thinking about him, that he would like to be a serial killer. I mean, that was an ambition, and that's in the 1950s. We get a lot of kids today who think that because there's so much stuff on TV, but there wasn't even the phrase serial killer in the 1950s. But he was very intrigued by some stories, like there was a H.H. Holmes story in a True Detective magazine, and Harvey Glattman, and then the Boston Strangler in 1962. And, you know, so he became very interested because he already had fantasies as a teenager of binding women and capturing women. He had girl traps that he would make. So he had these elaborate adolescent fantasies of capturing women. So those serial killers who operated along those lines inspired him and made him think that's eventually what he would like to do. So he had these weird ambitions as a teenager. But he didn't act on them. It was later he went into the military and did all that. And then came home and got married. It was being laid off from a job. He got very, very angry. So we have a serial killer who already has multiple fantasies across well over a decade of being a serial killer from these magazines. Now he's also angry. He also likes the idea of breaking into people's homes because it makes him feel like he's in charge and in control. And then he's got lust building as well. So he's got a braided threads of several different motives going on that compel him throughout the years that he was killing people.
Well, and then he ultimately gives himself away in almost a comical way. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, I actually thought it was comical until I found out more. He was more careful than people give him credit for. He already knew how to use computers in 2004, 2005. He already understood how to do, because he was planning on putting all his records onto CDs and whatnot to store in a safe deposit box in case he ended up dying and he wanted somebody to discover it and realize he was BTK. So make sure he got that legacy out there somehow. So he already knew how to do these things, and he actually asked an officer who he knew was in the digital kind of crime. Although I got to tell you, some of the digital crime stuff back in those days, and I know, I'm sure you know, Jan, how poor it was. He actually asked an officer, can you trace someone using a computer diskette? And that officer said no, not because he was trying to be clever, because he was ignorant.
I have no trouble believing that. No trouble at all believing that.
So, because he gave
comedy, but it's on the wrong side.
Exactly. The comedy is on the law enforcement side. The guy has actually admitted that he gave him the wrong information. But inadvertently, so Rader thought, because what Rader had been doing was taking the notes he had written to police and copying them and then taking the copies and copying them on another copier and then copying them another copier to keep them from being able to trace him through copiers. So he was so tired of doing that, and the computer seemed so easy that he thought, so they asked this guy, can I be traced? And the guy said no. So then he tried to affirm that with the investigative team. And, of course, in their mind, they know it can be. And they think, can he really be that stupid that he's asking us this? And they said, no, we can't trace you. And so he sends a diskette with that can be traced. And it was one that he was using for church business. And so it was the church computer. And when they went to the church and asked the pastor, is there someone there named Dennis? Because he had left his notes on the diskette. He had erased them, but, you know, they could trace that. And the pastor said, yeah, I let him use this computer. Now, Rader, understand, did have his own computer at home and printer, but it was malfunctioning. So he was using the church's. It was actually not so much comical as just sort of lucky on so many different counts that it turned out that way. It wasn't that he was stupid. He really was trying to be very careful, but people were giving him the wrong information.
We're lucky about that. Thank God that his home computer crashed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know. And that he happened to talk to one so-called digital investigator who really didn't know his stuff.
Like asking the checkout guy at the pharmacy what you need, what medicine you need for a treatment or something. You know?
Like
I don't
that.
Know.
Exactly. So the more I found out, the more I realized he was trying to be careful in the way he had always been, but he just happened to ask the wrong people. And then when he developed, and he did, I would say, naively develop this sense that he and the law enforcement, Kenneth Landwehr, were kind of buddies, and that Landwehr would be honest with him. So that's very naive. And that was part of it. It was that he thought, well, we have this thing going. Why did you lie to me? I wanted to
tell
you.
That's not fair.
That's what he exactly. And there is that weird childlike quality about him. There really is. When we talk, there is that sense of why would anyone be, you know, lie to me?
Yeah. I'm only, you know, suffocating and killing people. Why are they being mean to me?
Exactly. Well, for example, when we started playing a game of chess. He says, the first thing he said to me was, now don't cheat. And I'm like, what the hell? You're a serial killer. I will cheat if I want to.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective on his mental status and state and how he thinks about things. That's interesting.
Oh, but it's like many of them.
Yeah.
Like John Wayne Gacy, I mean, he would go off on religion and family and whatnot. And you're like, what? Excuse me?
Yeah.
You killed 33 people. You think you can talk about the divorce in America today like from some moral
taking
stand?
The moral high.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But, you know, it's not surprising because when you really study these guys, you know that they – well, actually, Rader calls it cubing. It's compartmentalization, which is I like Rader's word better because it's shorter. But it really gets at that you can when you're cubing, you're on one side and you don't see all the others, and that is very true of many of these, especially organized predatory serial killers, is they've managed to develop in such a way that they can think in compartments and they can think have a completely different moral universes that contradict one another. But they don't feel the contradiction. They don't feel it at all. And I tested Rader on this so many times, and he really, truly has a wall up between certain things that he believes and that the ways he acted. He really doesn't penetrate that wall.
So it depends on what mental room he's in at the time.
Well, yeah, and that, to me, in psychology, was the most interesting facet of this is – You think you can talk to someone in a reasonable way? Like, can't you see how you're contradicting yourself? And a normal person would be embarrassed and go, "Oh," but no, that is impenetrable. And you have to wonder, how did they manage to wax that up so well? You know, that's so interesting to me.
What did you find, you know, the commonalities he had with other, you know, famous serial killers, and what was different about him? Or what were the similarities and contrasts between the other people we know, the Ridgeways and Bundys and all those people of the world?
Well, there were some that he adhered to, like they were his role models, like Jack the Ripper, because he got away with it. He or she or they got away with it.
Yeah.
Ted Bundy, because he commanded so much media attention, and was a sort of a suave. And actually, you know, a lot of people think of Dennis Rader, when they think of him, they think of what he looked like when he was arrested. But when he was young and actually a serial killer, he was quite Bundy-esque. He was a good-looking guy, thin and thick, and with a thick head of dark hair, and he was good-looking. So he liked Bundy because Bundy had that suaveness that commanded media. He liked the Boston Strangler because of the strangulation methods that he used and whatnot. So there were certain role models that he adhered to and others that he totally ignored because they weren't doing what he kind of did. So that makes him makes him a little bit different. There are serial killers who study other serial killers and even communicate with them and use them as role models. But they're really kind of few and far between. And
or some
he's
of them
one
like
of
Facebook
those.
Friends or something.
Well, you know, they will, like, we had a healthcare serial killer here, Charles Cullen, who wrote to Donald Harvey, for example.
Yeah.
Because they want to learn more. How did you get away with this? How did you do this? What techniques did you use? Blah, blah, blah. But typically you're not going to find somebody thinking, I'm going to be H.H. Holmes or Harvey Glattman or something like that. So that's what makes him different, in that he had role models that drew him into it more than he had a sexual compulsion to do it. But what makes him similar is the predatory, organized kind of behavior, where he's very calculated, he's thinking it all through, he keeps journals about it, he keeps mementos. That's very similar to other organized killers who want to relive their crimes, who want to feel powerful and also have this double life. He thought of himself as a spy kind of thing, and that's kind of unusual, but that was one of his fantasies, is that he had to be clever like that. And frankly, he was. He got away with it for 30 years. I mean, that made him unusual.
Absolutely. Well, you have another project coming up, probably one of many, but the Ripper Letter, and I understand that it's going to be kind of a supernatural thriller kind of based on Ripperology and some other things. And,
yeah.
Tell us about that. Why did you get interested in that, and what's this all about?
Well, it kind of actually started with my literary agent, who wanted me to do something like sort of vampiric but different. And I found some secret societies during the Ripper. Now, I wouldn't call myself a Ripperologist, except I'm probably the Ripperologist of the Lehigh Valley. I would say that. And maybe all of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's your license plate on your car.
I should have that. I don't consider myself like up there with those people who devote their whole lives for many, many years to every aspect of Ripperology. But I've read quite a few of the books about it. And one of the ones that really interested me most was some of the occultic groups that sprang up during the same year as Jack the Ripper, who also had associations with like medieval coding systems and whatnot. So that sort of got me started, because I thought, well, that's interesting. If this particular cult started in 1888, when Jack the Ripper was, you know, in London doing his thing, and one of their members was a suspect who was pulled in by the police, and that member is a viable suspect, and that cult has all these other roots in more interesting things besides Jack the Ripper. So that kind of gave me the start of it. And then I created this whole supernatural world of unique beings that were protectors of the codes and whatnot. It became an erotic supernatural thriller. because everything is read through erotic codes. It's not just plain old codes. It has to be erotic codes. And I pulled in something that Napoleon had used to try to predict what he was going to do. He had a particular device that he used. I pulled that in, but I charged it up with erotic energy while I was at it. So I had erotic. It was very fun.
Well, what's next for you? Are you working on anything else right now?
Certainly the sequel to the Ripper Letter. Because how can you let that go?
Yeah, really.
So there's that for fiction, but also for nonfiction, I am writing a book called Forensic Investigation, Methods from Experts, where I interview a number of people who are doing things like first responder duties, entomology, toxicology, blood spatter pattern evidence, whatever. My local coroner, I pulled him in, various detectives and whatnot. So essentially I start each chapter with a case. I then have the experts talk about what they do, and it's not like a regular textbook. I call it my untextbook because I hate textbooks, and I told this company who asked me to write it that I don't use textbooks, and they said, that's why we're asking you to write it. So I said I would write it like a sort of Malcolm Gladwell meets CSI, where I can actually talk to the experts, put them in motion, go out with them in the field to watch dead bodies form maggots and such things as that, and then write about that. And then at the end, rather than the typical Q&A that you get in these textbooks, they would have thinking problems based on cases, so they'd have to apply the practical stuff they just got from the experts to a case. So it's different. It's a textbook, but it's different.
Well, because we have the luxury of a few more minutes, I'm going to ask a question I have been thinking about asking you throughout the evening, and that is, can you talk to us a little bit about being, as an investigator in forensic psychology, talking to serial killers, how things are different as a woman interviewer in that case versus your male colleagues?
Women interviewers actually have an interesting advantage, depending on the killer, because some killers, of course, hate women, and so you can actually get them all riled up, and they'll say things because they're really angry that you're there, and they're trying to control you or do something, so you can kind of get more out of them. But also, for example, Gary Ridgway is a good one. We talked about him, the Green River Killer. There was an FBI female agent who interviewed him at length, Mary Ellen O'Toole, and I watched the tapes of that interview. She was able to, even though he was, you know, clearly, I'm ridding the world of prostitutes, he hated women, etc., she was able to talk in such a soft, soothing way that he kept leaning toward her, and he started to say things that there's no way a male is going to get that out of him, because they're angry at him. Even if they're trying to buddy up to him, there's going to be that sort of ego thing in the middle of it. But watching her do that was very interesting, and I think women can have that advantage of being kind of soft and whether you are nurturing or not, because I'm not, but they think you are. So you can play on that, and you can use it to get them to move into this energy that they sort of despise and also need at the same time. Mm. I mean, Bates Motel, that's a good TV show, because I watched that with Dennis Rader, and we talk about that. That actually shows you that kind of interesting love-hate dynamic that a female can exploit in a way that a male cannot. And I think females have a real advantage if they know how to play it.
So you said you watched that with Dennis Rader.
Well, not like I'm
blank.
In his cell. Really, I would have actually never watched the show because I thought it sounded really corny. However, he said, when he said, you should watch that show because they really are getting at something there, we started watching it and then talking about it. So, because we talked every week, we could talk about what had just happened on the show. And through that, it's almost like when Ted Bundy's trying to tell Keppel about the Green River Killer,
right,
the Riverman.
Right.
Through that, he's actually revealing stuff about himself. And so I found Bates Motel and some other shows that Rader wanted me to watch to be, and I got him to watch a few things as well. Those shows were metaphors of things going on not only in his life, but how he developed into a serial killer. And through those shows, it was a great channel for being able to get him talking in a way that he might not otherwise have talked, just with a bare direct question, but indirectly. Mm. There was a lot that I learned just by talking about characters in the show.
Well, I mean, what was it like? I mean, you had some face-to-face with him. What was the setup? What did the room, the situation, the positions, the chair, table, what was all that like?
Oh, well, in a max security, you have to
right.
go through monitors.
Right.
But what was interesting was when he didn't know I was there, actually, the first time I met him. He didn't know it was me because I wasn't sure I was going to make it, even though I knew I'd be in Kansas. I wasn't sure. So they bring him in and he starts, and they're handcuffing him to the chair and his little booth and whatnot. And he's like, well, you know, very gruff and like he's trying to put on a show for them. What do you think? I'm Hannibal Lecter. And he doesn't know that I can see him. So when he realizes it's me, he completely changes, which was very, very interesting to watch because I knew at that point he plays to his audience.
Right.
Because he wanted the guards to think he was, But me, did you have a nice trip? But he didn't know that I had seen all this stuff leading up to him sitting there in front of me. And
you were in a different cube.
Yeah. So then the way you do it is through monitors and phones. It's
right.
not like I wouldn't be able to touch him or something like that. And that's when I realized this doesn't work as well as just talking on the phone, because on the phone it's very easy, funny, we joke and whatnot. There's no guards around, whereas in there the guards are hovering outside your cubicle, watching. What are you saying? It was so stultifying in terms of all you could do is pleasantries and I went out to this bridge, you know what bridge I'm talking about, meaning where he dumped a body or something like that. But then you really can't say much in terms of anything really detailed. He's not going to really talk. So it was just about meeting face to face, seeing each other face to face. And truly, the most work was done through letters and the phone. I mean, the letters he would write were really very, very long and detailed. He was quite interesting. He would draw a lot of stuff. He would draw his torture fantasies, for example, that were very elaborate. And I found that to be a much more effective way of communicating with him than face-to-face. I know that the stereotype is you have to sit there in prison looking at each other.
Right.
But that really was probably, I thought, the least effective way to get information.
But it
didn't really help me much.
Wasn't one of his torture methods, wasn't he big on plastic bags and stuff like that, suffocating?
That was one thing. That was one that came in late in his fantasy life. He read a book, a fiction, about another serial killer who did that, so he thought he'd try it out. That wasn't something he initiated. He just read it in some novel. And I talk about that in the book, what novel he got it out of and why he tried it, and it ended up not being as great as it seemed. It sounded good in fiction. It wasn't so great trying it out. He had a lot of different devices that he would use. He did a number of things on himself. So a lot of the book is devoted to the variety of fantasies he had and what he would do to go, how he'd go shopping to buy things to make all that work for him. He had a lot of different things. And then evolved, you know, as they do. You're not going to have the same fantasies as an adolescent you have as, you know, a 40-year-old man. So the interesting thing is how they evolve. And then in the end, he drew for me this, the ultimate thing that he was going to build was his, like he loved barns and silos. That was the big thing. And he would elaborately fill them in his fantasy life with all kinds of torture devices and all kinds of layers. And right before he got caught, he was planning on actually building a silo with all these devices. So he drew this very elaborate torture silo for me.
Mm.
And I said to my editor, and it was already past, you know, the deadline. I said, I don't care what your deadline is. You put this in the book. Because it's all right here, crystallized perfectly.
Yes.
The maturation of his fantasy life is right here. And I was the only one who had the copy. He gave me the original.
Amazing.
So, you know, and so you get to that point where, wow, a serial killer trusts you. That's something, you know. Hence, you have to be careful about the birthday cards you find. Found one that says something like, I better not be late because I know you'd kill me.
Oh, no.
I can't send that, but that's so funny. But that is a challenge year to year because, you know, they just don't make cards appropriate for people in prison. They just don't.
Especially people in prison for serial killing.
Exactly. Well, I was shopping this year, and this elderly man comes up to me because he sees that I'm looking at every single card and not finding one. He goes, honey, it doesn't matter what it says. It just matters how much money you put into it. I thought if only he knew who I'm shopping for.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it matters
to
this guy.
I loved that one. I thought that was great. But, so every year it's a challenge to find appropriate, unsentimental kinds of cards that will work. But, you know, we do things like, you know, he'll see the moon cycles, and he'll talk about the birds he sees and the flowers that are coming up because he's got a window. And so you have to find – now, I'll tell you one chilling thing, and I know we're probably over time, but it was a chilling thing where I was trying to get hummingbirds to my deck when I had this particular house. And I was in a store looking at a magazine that had a whole article about hummingbirds, and he knew, you know, that I was trying to get these hummingbirds to come. He sends me an article he cut out from a magazine. It is the exact article I was looking at. That was chilling.
That's scary.
Yes.
Especially for an aficionado of the occult, as you are.
I know. It's like, oh, my God, was he looking over my shoulder? So there were many adventures along the way, and I never expected it to take as long as it did. I really didn't. But,
well, I
you know,
can't wait
I think
to read
were,
it. I can't
there
wait to read it.
Yeah, there was a deepening quality to it because it took so long. I think it wouldn't have been the book it ended up being had I not spent the time on it that I did.
Percolating time, exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of percolating. Yeah, exactly.
And all that time, you know, to remind our listeners to benefit the families of the victims.
Yes.
Yes, it is. And yes, and I don't think I would have done it without that part of it.
Yeah.
They get the proceeds of the book.
And, of course, we'll have links to Catherine's site and the books and all that online, as we always do. Catherine, this has been wonderful. You know, it's never long enough, never often enough. Just fantastic. And we'll get you back again down the road because we just always have too much fun.
It's fun.
I can't wait to read it, and I can't wait for the Ripper letter.
You'll never be the same.
That wraps up this edition of Crime and Science Radio. Thank you all for being with us, and we'll see you down the road.